Interview with Richard Ketchum, April 17th, 2008, in New York City by Kenneth Durr.
Well, let's start out with some background. You went to Tufts, right?
Went to Tufts.
Okay.
And NYU Law School. And after NYU Law School, I worked at Milbank Tweed Hadley & McCloy for a couple years after that. Coming out of law school, I was actually, this being the end of the Vietnam War, and my draft number being 26, I was initially scheduled, was in Navy JAG, and somewhere around 1974, or the beginning of my third year of law school in 75, the war was winding down, and they looked around and said, we would want that many lawyers in the Navy for what reason? So I found myself looking for a job fairly quickly, ended up in a large firm, Milbank, with some great people, but mostly doing, a large part doing a variety of loan agreement work for Chase Manhattan Bank, which was Milbank's largest client at the time, and still is to some degree. And that didn't feel like what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. No dramatic or profound inclination to securities regulation. Probably the reason that it tweaked an interest was two things. First, I took a securities reg course, which I really enjoyed in law school, taught by Marty Lipton, a pretty well known guy from this that side of things. And then, about the only work that I did at Milbank that particularly intrigued me, in the midst of all the loan agreements and the like, was. This was the time in 1977, shortly after, or 76 and 77, since I started in Milbank in 75, shortly after the 75 Act Amendments, Securities Reform Act, with that, the enactment of the national market system, and the Commission's proposal to, in various tranches, remove off-board trading restrictions that, most importantly, were in place for the New York Stock Exchange, and restricted trading with respect to restricted upstairs trading. And a client of the Milbank Tweed was the New York Stock Exchange. So I spent some time analyzing some of the earlier releases and putting together pieces of their preparation for a comment letter. On a couple of the proposals, running up to when I left Milbank at the summer of 77, and sort of immediately got dumped to market regulation, where I sort of split time between what was then a single office, the Office of Trading Practices and Market Structure, half of which was. Interpretive work, which was great to really begin to understand how the industry and capital raising worked, because it was things like Rule 10b-6 and 10b-13, all now renumbered, of course.
So you're interpreting those
half
rules.
Of it was interpreting things with respect to trading around offerings and other areas where there might be particular manipulative risk, and half of it was the market structure office. Which was essentially the Office of Market Regulation given responsibility for implementing Section 11A of the Act and the new, essentially the things that came out of the 75 Act Amendments. So I moved from doing a variety of analyses and preparing parts of New York Stock Exchange comments to sitting taking notes as the grunt in the group for the National Market Advisory Board, and again getting sort of an early introduction into understanding markets better and understanding this really the fascinating issues that were posed by the Commission getting involved with market structure issues in an area that, putting aside the gradual unfixing of commissions during the short years before, had never really been a part of the Commission's mandate.
Right. Tell me a little bit about this National Market Advisory Board. Who were those people?
The National Market Advisory Board was set up immediately after the statute was adopted in 75. It involved, well, probably the most two famous or infamous people were to involve representatives with respect to the securities industry one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps most notably remembered were Don Stone, who later became a vice chairman of the New York Stock Exchange and was generally considered to be a very articulate voice for the specialist community. He owned a specialist firm and a voice for auction markets and a voice for the exchange. And Don Wheaton, who had created Wheaton & Co. And was one of the most outspoken people, if not the most outspoken people, on a variety of issues ranging from unfixing of commissions to moving to a computerized trading environment as opposed to an exchange environment. And then a range of other people in the industry. But Stone and Wheaton were fairly famous for long dialectics between them, and if not shouting on occasion. So there are basically sort of two pieces to my education in that year. One was that, and the other was this was the time after the commission had proposed the complete removal of off-board trading restrictions, what was then Rule 19C2, never adopted. And again, as the new grunt in the office, or one of the young attorneys in this joint office, I spent time essentially summarizing testimony with respect to the public hearings the commission had on it throughout the late summer and early fall of 77.
Was the testimony resoundingly negative? Is that why?
Testimony was resoundingly negative. Yes. Not totally negative, obviously. People like the NESD were quite positive about it. But there was relatively little support in the industry for the risk-taking involved in really what would have been a dramatic single-step change in trading environment in a time when computerized trading was still in infancy as opposed to when you saw all these things roll out decades later. One of the famous letters was a letter from the city of New York in which their quote was that the result of the commission's aberrant action will be there will be grass growing on Wall Street.
This is in regards to Rule 390?
This is in regards to Rule 390, New York Stock Exchange Rule 390. Without jumping ahead of the story, as you know, what the commission did over a period of years, which I think really set forth much of the competitive philosophy of the commission for the next 20 years, was come to a fairly solid. First, it pulled back from 19C2, took no action immediately,
right.
But then adopted Rule 19C3, which basically put a cap and on a prospective basis didn't permit the application of off-board trading restrictions. So essentially, for new listings, off-board trading restrictions couldn't be applied. And while that had no significant impact initially, it began to create the environment and the opportunity for trading away from the exchange and in a probably fairly sensible way.
Was that done in the late 70s?
Rule 19C3, I believe, was done, if I remember, I think it was 1979.
Okay.
If it wasn't 1979, it was 1980, but I think it was 79. You know, it was in a time of really pretty substantial sets of ferment. The commission did a variety of significant things then. It adopted the firm quote rule that has been really one of the significant building blocks of modern trading market structure. It required for the first time for NASDAQ securities that they actually have trade reporting and eliminated something called the representative bid and ask with respect to quotations. Hard to imagine that just 30 years ago, obviously the NASDAQ market was much, much smaller,
right,
and had many, and was mostly relatively small companies with a very few exceptions in that time, way before the computer revolution basically gave the NASDAQ a base to become a much, much more significant competitor. But nevertheless, hard to imagine the NASDAQ market at that point. You didn't know when trades had occurred, when they were reported. And the quote that the public saw, as opposed to the quote that competing market makers saw, was an average quote. It wasn't the actual best bid and the best offer. It was an average in between, and averages are never as competitive. So it basically built in a guaranteed an increased profit versus the price that the public would get versus the price the dealers could go replenish their liquidity at out in the marketplace. So anyway, a time of really the late 1970s were the first tranche of the National Market System program from the standpoint of making sure that quotes were available. Something called the vendor display rule was adopted, in which it was required that a consolidated picture of quotations, or at least a consolidated quote, was required by vendors to be displayed so that it was accessible to investors. Again, something never occurred before. So great action in quotes. For the first time in NASDAQ, you had trade reporting, and you begin the process of the commission encouraging competition. So that gets ahead of my story. But anyway, that's how I rolled into the commission by accident, fleeing a large law firm with respect to something that had tweaked my attention and fascination. Then probably the second...
Who did you work for? Who led the way for you?
Andy Klein was my director. He became my director a few weeks after Lee Picard was just leaving as director when I arrived. Andy became my director a few weeks after I got there. Shortly after that, Lloyd Feller became my associate director. Again, both longtime commission employees. Lloyd, both have had extremely successful law firm careers afterwards. Andy and Schiff Hardin and Lloyd at Morgan, Lewis and Bacchius, and then on to a variety of spots. He's now the general counsel of Jefferies. It was an incredibly exciting time in market regulation. Market regulation, not having been known as the forefront cutting edge of the commission over a period for much of a period of time, but you really... Market Reg during that time was really asked to rethink the commission's mission in a variety of ways. The commission, properly so, has been honored as fundamentally a disclosure and enforcement agency, and with that an investor protection agency.
Right.
For the first time, with the issues that came through from everything from the special study to the institutional investor study, to the Act in 75, with the Act in 75, ranging from the question of unfixing commissions to the question of how market structure should be designed, for the first time, the commission was being asked to play a role in design, not actually on a micro design in implementing how the system should work, but at least a role in creating a set of rules that set the boundaries in which how competition would occur. And for the first time, with a very clear objective, albeit one among others that had to be balanced, if you look at Section 11A, you see it as this sort of exercise in contradictions of a variety of goals that have to be balanced in taking action. But for the first time, a very clear articulation, and you saw it in other sections of the Act coming out of the 75 Act amendments as well, that the Commission's job was to ensure fair competition. And to, where appropriate and consistent with other goals of the Act, eliminate burdens on competition. So you suddenly had, and not that the Commission didn't worry some about these issues before, but you suddenly had a whole different approach from the standpoint of the Commission's responsibilities to be a pro-competitive agency, albeit one more balanced and different than the FTC or the Justice Department and the like. Competition wasn't the only thing to worry about, but to be balanced. And to be worried about the structure of the industry and to try to look to the structure that would meet some goals. And those goals basically were to be more transparent, things like trade and quote reporting, to be more competitive, things like providing an ability for people to compete fairly against what were then fairly monolithic competitors, including the place I work now, the New York Stock Exchange, right, the American Stock Exchange, et cetera.
Well, what about convergence of all of the exchanges? I mean, when you say national market system, you sort of think of bringing all these disparate units together.
Well, that was really the debate and continued the debate until arguably where you are today, when the SEC has created a again, along with technology and the steps the SEC made, and I'll try to walk you through those steps, has created what you could argue is a virtual convergence, while allowing exchanges to continue to compete with each other, only compete with each other in a way where there's instantaneous linking and instantaneous access, and with Reg NMS, very clear requirements as to when you have to go out and get better prices and how you display.
But there was a sense back then that somewhere in the future, this was a desirable outcome.
There was certainly a sense in the staff, but it was a statute that, as I say, was embedded with contradictions and many different visions of what that meant. For vision, and remembering, you're in a time of less complete computerization, to say the least, and much increased cost with respect to development. But the visions, and if you go back through the legislative history, you'll see even conflicting legislative history in this, ran from everything to complete convergence, as you described, which would have been a consolidated limit order book in which all priced orders had to be together in a single book, and exchanges, which of course back then were all exchange floors, and the NASDAQ market, which of course back then was really a light connection of competing market makers who put out quotations in various offices of competing broker dealers. So your one vision, not accepted by many, was a consolidated limit order book. Another vision was just open-ended competition, where upstairs firms would have the ability to compete and hold on to their orders by internalizing those orders, and that was one of the issues with respect to Rule 19c2. Even though the linkages hadn't been put together. A third vision, so you had kind of two radical visions, one of which was a total consolidation, the other was somewhat of a total fragmentation. And without getting into the arguments whether it was good or bad and what conflicts of interest there might have been in the rest, the third vision was a more pragmatic, incremental vision, which the commission sort of played referee on from the range of the exchange's vision, which would have been very pragmatic and very little incremental, to the commission's efforts to try to move that along the path. And that third vision was basically what the commission adopted in the late 70s, which was to say, okay, we're not ready, and it's interesting, actually, at least I find it interesting from a governance standpoint, because it is an interesting question of how much risk a regulatory agency is willing to take and expose to an important industry in the United States. There was a beauty with respect to consolidated limit order book and pulling it all together at a fundamental fairness, a complete transparency of all interest, it would have arguably completely eliminated the ability for the exchanges to operate and provide separate markets. It would have basically turned on its head the existing market structure and moved to something else, which you would have had to take in faith was going to be better.
Right. And you wouldn't know. I mean,
and it would be hard to say no. And unlike today, where you look and say, "Well, I see those all over the world," there was no example out there. And so, where the commission basically said is, you know, I see a lot of things here in 11A that make sense to me. I want to encourage competition. I want to have more complete trade and quote information so that people can make better decisions. I also want to control my risk. So what the commission did was a combination of rulemaking and linkages. It pushed the linkages through the exchanges and NASDAQ so that there would be a trading connection between markets, linking so that you could go out and get to better prices, but with nothing other than best execution requirements initially governing that. And then a set of rules that said, okay, we're going to have consolidated quote information, we're going to have consolidated trade information, we're going to eliminate off-board trading restrictions on a prospective standpoint so it doesn't all happen in a big bang, and we're going to bring NASDAQ into an environment that has the same sort of trade and quote information that the exchanges have historically had. So we're going to take the huge differences between the NASDAQ environment and the exchange market, and without demanding one market structure or another, we're going to pull together from the standpoint of transparency. And then, and the last piece, which I note you have down here, was questions with respect to the definition of exchange, which begin, and I know you have your questions with respect to early electronic trading systems.
Right.
The last piece was some creativity with respect to the definition of exchange that led the commission staff to do a series of no-action letters that permitted trading systems like InstaNet to operate without being required to register, something that didn't occur in most of the rest of the world. And with that, it began in a very minimalistic standpoint, but then obviously growing to be hugely important in the late 80s and the 90s, an environment where people could innovate and with lower cost and without the same restrictions you had with an exchange.
Was the fear that if you didn't take this no action approach that these things would just be strangled and
died? Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, they died for years in the rest of the world, other than in the United States. Now, partially because the U.S. capital markets are so huge,
yeah.
But also partly because they were allowed to operate without exchange registrations and the like, so that their costs and flexibility were great. Now, that led to many competitive issues as they grew and thrived, which led to things like Reg ATS, but I get ahead of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll give you one last anecdote, and I won't give you any more personal anecdotes. But probably the other key thing of my early piece of the commission career and kind of rolling into the other major development which characterizes the 70s and 80s from a financial market standpoint and from an SEC market regulation standpoint is derivatives. Obviously a subject of some interest even today.
Yeah,
And that was probably my biggest break of my career. As I said, I got dropped into this office that first allowed me to start learning that head is a fundamental culture and ethic, partially driven by the new legislation, of a fascination for how markets worked and how the industry worked. After doing that for a relatively short time, about 6 months, at the very same time, the options markets imploded. There were very significant sales practice concerns. This was a product that had begun in the standardized options with a clearing corporation, had begun with Joe Sullivan and the CBOE in the early 70s, had exploded, other exchanges had joined, and suddenly there was, firms were selling these things all over the place without people really understanding, very poor disclosure of what the risk of options were and the like. And also there became market structure issues as to whether there should be multiple trading of options and a variety of other things. So Chairman Williams, Harold Williams, chairman at the time, and the commission declared a moratorium on options expansion, an action of perhaps somewhat questionable legality, but abided to by the options exchanges. And with that moratorium, along with not being willing to have accept rule filings that would have expanded any business of the options exchanges, he created an option study that was headed by Marty Budd. And basically people were drafted into the option study from each of the relevant divisions. An interesting cast of characters, some of which you have either interviewed or I bet you'll interview over time. Gary Lynch was on the option study. Marianne Smythe was on the option study as two notable division directors going forward, and I was. The option study was a wonderful. First, it was a great time. It was a wonderful piece of my career because the great thing about a study is for the first few months, the senior people in the study think deep thoughts, talk to senior people, and write outlines. So that the rest of us just didn't sit around twiddling our thumbs. We basically sat around. It was the first time I ever got to read the special study, the institutional investor study, a variety of things on options pricing theory. And then we got dropped on trading floors at the New York Stock Exchange, at the CBOE, on the American Stock Exchange, and up on the trading floor of Merrill Lynch. And then for the last 6 months, for better or worse, we wrote the option study, and it moved the commission on its path towards how options developed. But I came out a year later not knowing a hell of a lot of derivatives, but compared to virtually everybody else at the SEC, knowing a ton. And given the fact that options, once the moratorium was lifted, along with the development in futures, both options and futures became focused on a huge rush of new products with respect to index products and a variety of things at the time that became less important on debt and a variety of other things.
Who's running the study?
Running the study was Marty Budd.
It was
run out of essentially with Chairman Williams' office heading it up. A guy by the name of Rick Weingarten, who had been the executive assistant to the chairman, was my boss as one of the leaders in the rest. Gary Lynch, I believe, was the head of one piece of the study on the enforcement side. And it was Rick Weingarten and I basically looking at the market structure issues.
Okay. How much direction did you get? I mean, you're getting to look at the other studies, how those were done, and they drop you on the exchange floors. But were you given an ultimate direction that you were supposed to be going in?
Well, we had an outline. The commission had in its moratorium, and then in the release that followed the moratorium, who knows, there may have been more than one, but my recollection is recent, basically outlined the issues. And the issues ranging from sales practice concerns to disclosure concerns and risk concerns with respect to the product,
okay.
Supervision concerns as to how broker-dealers reviewed supervision, and then the market structure concerns. Should there be multiple trading in the marketplace? There were different models of trading and options. There were competing market maker models and specialist models, and basically to look at all that. And a significant amount of things came out of the option study, out of the problems, particularly on the supervision side, very specific supervision requirements with respect to options that to this day in the exchange rules differ from the more general supervision rules with respect to other products. Disclosure document that has now been whittled into something more rational, but ensured much better disclosure of the risks. There had always been a disclosure document, but refocusing that on the risks and really focusing firms on providing much better disclosure and suitability with respect to people buying this type of leverage product. So the commission basically focused and identified the areas, and then we were kind of on our own to write the study.
So did the study come out while Harold Williams was still in there?
Study did come out while Harold was still there. The study came out, began in January of 1978, issued right around the end of the year, beginning of 1979.
Okay.
I returned to market regulation at that point, still now completely in what was the Office of Market Structure, no longer worrying about interpretations. As I say, that continued, that dropped me right back into what had begun the ferment of things like the firm adopting the firm quote rule, requiring trade reporting for NASDAQ securities, one of the things I worked a lot on, vendor display rule, and the variety of other pieces that were going on at that point, and a pretty neat time. Then, as I say, one of the wonderful things about the option study from that standpoint, 1980 happened. President Carter was defeated by Ronald Reagan, and a somewhat different regulatory philosophy was blessed on the SEC. This was just after I had been promoted to associate director after George Simon left to go to a law firm, who had been, again, one of my mentors. Again, so a very respected person in the securities bar throughout the years afterwards. And with the associate director responsibilities, I moved from just the narrow focus on the market structure issues and the national market system issues to a broader responsibility for oversight over the whole self-regulatory rule filing process, and with that, the options rule filing process. I'll just tell one anecdote with respect to Chairman Shadd in the early years. So here we are, beginning of the Reagan administration. I think it would be probably fair to say that many of the senior people in market regulation were more on the Democratic side of the philosophical aisle, and certainly were by nature reasonably activist and enthused about programs like the market structure program, et cetera. Obviously, Chairman Shadd was coming. Chairman Shadd was formerly vice chairman of E.F. Hutton, had been brought in with a clear mandate to deregulate. And the first time I met Sherman Chad, who became a good friend and somebody that I dearly loved, despite the fact we didn't agree on many things, was after Market Reg had a softball team. And after a softball game, I headed back to the office to pick up my stuff at about 8 o'clock at night. And the name of our team was the Regulators, from Market Regulation.
Yeah, sure.
So here I am, the first time I meet John Chad, getting in the elevator with his burgundy shirt, grubby from playing a couple hours in a reasonably hot climate, with Regulators sitting on the front of my shirt. John looked at me, clearly didn't recognize me, pointed at my shirt and said, "What's that?" And I tried to get out as quickly as I could without identifying my name.
Uniform for the SEC.
Well, I thought, in retrospect, I should have said, you know, we had a game with the CFTC and we won, so we got to keep their uniforms. We, of course, would never have such a thing. Anyway, that shift, as I became associate director, really was fortuitous for my career again, because in a deregulatory environment, we stopped doing rules with respect to the national market system for a period of years. Mm-hmm. And with the one exception of completing the requirement of trade reporting for NASDAQ securities. And the real shift in focus was now driven by the exchanges with respect to the ferment and growth with regard to the options market and the futures market. And for the first time, there became the concerns that survived for the rest of my SEC career and then live through today with the Treasury blueprint with regard to the merger of the SEC and CFTC, were really spilling out because of the huge growth of futures in the financial side and the shift of that from things like Treasury bonds to stock index futures. And with that, the ferment of developing products on the futures side, ferment of developing products on the options side, the issues with respect to jurisdiction regarding those products, and then the concern of the impact of futures on trading in the underlying securities, and the issues of having two different regulators with very different statutes and with that very different philosophies of regulation as a result of that.
Did Market Reg have any input on the CFTC on the Chad Johnson?
Yes, Dan. I'm sure you may have heard some about that with your interview with Dan Gallagher, because Dan was the lead negotiator in that. The director of market regulation in that time was Doug Scarf, and I basically supported Doug with respect to Market Reg's support of the chairman in those negotiations. That then, as time went on, you can always trust general counsel to get out once the glamour is done. Market Reg was really the division responsible for the application of the Chad Johnson Accord. And things like questions of what was a narrow-based versus a broad-based index and things of that sort as to what were permissible futures products under the Accord and what were not permissible futures products under the Accord.
Did the two agencies have responsibility for narrow and broad? Yeah. Were those split?
Well, it was not so much split. The options, there was no limitation on the type of index that could be traded in the options market because the SEC had jurisdiction and they were all securities. The CFTC essentially agreed, the definition of futures was quite broad and resulted in the SEC losing a variety of lawsuits over the over years there past. The CFTC basically, to avoid a jurisdictional brawl, agreed to a limitation in the Chad Johnson Accord that they would only bring on broad-based futures.
Okay.
And the theory of that was that narrow-based futures started to look more and more like futures on an individual security, which were actually prohibited. And that the goal was, so individual security futures were prohibited and narrow-based futures were not permitted in order to avoid concern of the different regulatory structures and the impact, undue impact of futures on securities. So a good deal of what we did in the next few years in a time, in a fairly deregulatory time, was focused, at least in this area. I see you have one share, one vote down separately.
Yes.
But was really looking at options, new products, and deciding what, you know, this all sounds rather bureaucratic and unfriendly from a competitive standpoint at the time, but deciding what type of futures products would be permitted and not permitted. And just to carry that thought through and then move to maybe other parts, that sort of rolls you up basically to the issues approaching the 1987 market crash. Mm-hmm. Because notwithstanding that restrictions, the really popular successful products and the most successful products were index options and index futures, particularly broad-based index futures, particularly the S&P 500 as the most successful product.
And here you've got the problem where the options trading and the trading of the securities is somehow related.
Well, that's right. The index futures and options are fundamentally derivatives of the basket of securities. Options you can essentially create with options trading the equivalent of a stock position. But mostly they react to one another. And under perfect theory, they react to changes in the stock price. But as you move with the development and the huge popularity and liquidity of index futures, that product began in a variety of times when markets got volatile to drive the prices of the stocks that were included in the basket, and because those were the biggest stocks, tended to drive the whole stock market. And the reason for that is sort of easy to understand from a visual standpoint. If you think of the stock market as a whole, as a huge aircraft carrier, and the index future as a very small PT boat. And the weight required to turn a PT boat is obviously much quicker than the weight to turn an aircraft carrier. To turn the entire stock market takes time. And this was a time when program trading was really beginning. It took and where electronic trading basically didn't exist in great pieces. And so the net effect was that if you really wanted on a market-wide basis to quickly become long or short, the most efficient way to do that was to trade index futures. And index futures started to have more and more impact on the underlying securities. Simultaneously, we were, for the first time in a very long time, from the 70s on, in a bull market. And with that bull market became more and more aggressive strategies to be able to use derivatives to take advantage of that. And with that, recognizing, rightly or wrongly, that there were lower margin requirements for futures, and thus, just as you see today, the ability to provide great leverage with respect to over-the-counter derivative products, there was greater ability to attain leverage and higher profitability than you could in the stock market. And those were really sort of the years of the seeds of the variety of issues that resulted in the crash occurring so quickly and so dramatically, without saying that there weren't fundamental economic reasons why the market reevaluated itself.
And the New York Stock Exchange at some point in here applied to trade options, is that right?
New York Stock Exchange applied to trade options at each of the other exchanges. Options have become a very successful product. The exchange applied to trade options. That led to questions of, gee, how do you operate with respect to the primary market in an environment where there was a great deal of market information available on the floor of the exchange, and what type of restrictions do you need to deal with that? And effectively what occurred there, which had occurred in a smaller amount in the other options exchanges that also traded stocks, was a wall. The exchange options were traded in a different room with very clear exclusions.
Was that the SEC's idea, or did the stock exchange say this?
Well, it was a discussion, but it's certainly the SEC had been very actively from the beginning in options trying to create a separation from market information standpoint between the stocks and the options. The initial walls that we were created at the American Stock Exchange and the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, Pacific Stock Exchange, were referred to as Rappaport walls, referring to who was the associate director of the division, a position I had later on during the 70s, a guy named Shelley Rappaport. So, yes, it was very much driven. The exchange went right down that road. Separately, that was in sort of a similar time frame. For the first time, it was hollowed out how specialists on the New York Stock Exchange would be able to trade options. They were both physically separated from it, and then there were very clear, very strict, very prescriptive standards. Certainly, looking backwards, way too prescriptive standards. Yeah. Vis-a-vis how they could use options to make sure that they were not only hedges but very clear hedges and couldn't be used in any way to front run the market or to manipulate the market.
How long did it take to sort of feel out those rules and the walls and the rules and bring things down to some kind of reasonable settlement?
Well, the walls really started before or my time when I was over in market structure while Shelley was the associate director. And it was hollowed out as part of the proposals in the 70s for each of the exchanges to operate. Specialist trading of options was, I think, as I recall, a multiple-year effort to reach agreement between the exchange and the staff in a way to be able to design this and begin to accept the fact that these markets were interlinked while not taking too great risks from a manipulation standpoint.
And there's a point here where you're looking at a system to link four of the five exchanges in trading options.
Philadelphia was
standing alone.
That's right. There was by the late 80s, one of the things that had come out of the option study was initially a continuing moratorium on multiply trading the same option among options exchanges. That was gradually unwound in the late 80s. And with that, an effort to create a linkage system that would emulate the type of system or hopefully be better than the type of system that ITS had become for equity securities. And the Philadelphia Stock Exchange did stand alone in its opposition of that, whereas the other... All the exchanges would have loved for there to be no multiple trading at all. And the commission went through... a series of economic analyses to basically demonstrate that there had been grandfathered multiple trading. So it basically studied the multiple trading that was occurring in the grandfathered issues and then gradually increased that and did a number of economic analyses to determine that multiple trading indeed resulted in better markets and narrower spreads and the like.
And in some respects, this is... coming back to the national market system idea, because
it absolutely winds back together. It's the same goals of 11A that the purpose of the commission is to remove burdens of competition, unless there's darn good reasons not to, from an investor protection standpoint or a market structure standpoint. And so again, yes, you start to see, and I'm sure in your interviews and in that you basically catch the next chapter as the rules and the structure of the options market start to converge with the rules and structure of the equity markets, though still obviously not with the regulation NMS and still some significant differences down to the day.
Well, you pointed out that, you know, this has a lot to do with getting to the 87 crash. Let's take a break and talk a little bit about internationalization.
Sure.
Because I noticed in my research that all of a sudden in 1986, there's all kinds of talk about internationalization. You were involved in a number of initiatives, and I want to get some sense of where did that all come from in the mid-1980s?
Well, it's an interesting question. The SEC began to become actively involved in IOSCO in the early 80s, but you had a variety of things gradually developing that forced us to pay greater attention to the international issues. People started to become very creative from a law violation standpoint, engaging in insider trading, using Swiss accounts or using accounts out in the Cayman Islands and the like, and a variety of other countries where there was difficulty because of secrecy laws and being able to access that information. And that didn't just come from sort of the notorious countries, but sort of as a reaction to Nazism and the rest, something that was held across Europe and which you still see in the EU confidentiality requirements, the far more restrictive than exist in the United States. So a key piece as we moved into the second half of the 1980s was trying to build a more efficient process to be able to exchange information for enforcement investigations. And that was something, and then more broadly was the questions that are just coming to fruition now of how do we get to an environment where you can move to mutual recognition, where you converge differences in accounting and disclosure requirements so that foreign companies would be more comfortable coming to the United States and you'd have a more efficient environment rather than requiring those companies to comply with every bit of our sets of requirements. And the last piece was people started buying foreign securities for the first time. And certainly, this was really the, not the beginning, but the real liftoff of the huge purchase of foreign securities, of U.S. securities by foreign persons in foreign countries. So with the bull markets in the U.S. for the 80s, for the first time there became people in a wide variety of foreign countries became less risk-averse, less focused on debt instruments, and began to participate in the U.S. securities market. So you had law violations as a part of that, and just the efforts to try securities firms suddenly cared a lot about how entities could deal with U.S. customers when they weren't registered as broker-dealers. And that led to a number of things that I think that are really very current today and are being really thought through again. The first was the initial memorandum of understanding for the sharing of information.
Right.
The initial one was done with the DTI, Department of Trade and Industry, before there was an FSA or even before there was a SFA, a SIB, back in the old financial structure of the United Kingdom. That was something that Gary Lynch, Mike Mann, and I were very involved in negotiating, along with the CFTC.
Now, this would have been the early 80s, right?
The initial one was, I'd say, mid-80s. I'm trying to think. I think the initial MOU was mid-80s.
Okay.
And that led to, that sort of served as a model, first going country by country. Mike Mann was a tremendous leader in all this from the international office. Gary Lynch had been very active, and then Bill McLucas picked it up when Gary was involved. Done first country by country setting up these MOUs for information exchange that led eventually to what now is the common parameter, which is IOSCO models and IOSCO-wide agreements of countries reaching in for information agreements to share information. The other piece was beginning rule activity with respect to how unregistered broker-dealers could operate to some limited degree in the United States. And that was the adoption of Rule 15A6, now being reconsidered by the Commission and hopefully being substantially expanded to deal with a new world, a new environment. But at the time, 15A6 was the first effort of the Commission to allow a limited ability for unregistered foreign broker-dealers to interact with institutional investors in the United States. Very high standard as to what an institutional investor was. A lot of requirements that there be chaperoning by a U.S. broker or the U.S. affiliate. Lots of duplicate books and records requirements. A variety of other things that are now properly criticized as way too burdensome. But it was the first step in allowing unregistered entities. And it basically has been the way unregistered affiliates have dealt with U.S. institutional investors over the last 15 years. And, you know, I think, again, sort of a milestone moment of the Commission really beginning the process of trying to grapple with the fact that markets were not becoming global, but access to markets and demand for markets were very much becoming global, both from the standpoint of good things to encourage access and efficiency and bad things from the standpoint of law violations.
What was the effect of the Big Bang on the London Exchange? Did that make the SEC sit up and take notice and think, you know, what are we going to do in this case?
Well, yeah, I mean, you basically, with lots of limping in between, you took extremely hide-bound market in the United Kingdom, albeit still the largest market in Europe, and changed it into a much more invigorated electronic marketplace that had many growing steps to be able to get to a point of being truly competitive. But for the first time, and a market that began looking outside of England for many of its listings and doing very aggressive international listings, so that the whole issues of international listings and the questions of the various impediments to listing in the United States became more and more significant. Because the first time, and it's really the beginning story of what now faces the United States 15 years later, or 20 years later, depending on where you measure it from, of equivalent markets existing in the world that are attractive to investors and attractive to people to raise capital, right, as opposed to a world that existed before because of everything from competitive restrictions to the development of the markets to the lack of regulatory requirements such as insider trading protections and arrest, where the only markets existing in the world tended to be very regional, not very competitive to the United States, and really not providing a meaningful competitive opportunity for large companies outside of the companies that existed in their own country.
Right.
And Big Bang pushed, not in a simple step, but basically created the push. Big Bang's sort of a good analogy because if you really think of it, it took a while for the universe to spread out. That made the London Stock Exchange much more of an equivalent competitive market, competitive alternative to the United States. And so again, I think is a central marking point for how regulatory philosophy had to change because competitive realities changed, just as regulatory philosophy had to change in things like national market system because the capabilities of technology and computer communication changed so much. So you're right to ask it. I think it was a big effort, and results coming out of that were the information sharing agreement with the United Kingdom that started things off.
And Rule 15 that was A6, you and Gary Lynch?
And Mike Mann.
Mm-hmm.
Head of International. And then all the things that Linda Quinn then became involved with after that from the standpoint of, particularly through the Arthur Levitt years, of trying to address some of, without changing the fundamental requirements of GAAP that are now being dealt with IFRS, of trying to make the U.S. markets more attractive. All of that reflects sort of a great example of how competitive realities change, and you have to make changes in your regulatory structure to be able to deal with that.
I mean, the argument's always made that the U.S. has not been sort of sat by while all this has happened. And nobody really took seriously that this could happen, that so much of the securities industry would go offshore. Would you say that was the case at the SEC or in the commission at all?
I think the commission in the mid-80s to late 80s through Richard Breeden's time and through certainly Arthur Levitt's effort and the rest took it quite seriously. And all the things I sort of rattled off were examples of they took it seriously. What you're right in saying is we still perceive the risk as limited, and we perceive the tremendous engine of capital raising that was the genius of the U.S. system as providing us a special position. And while we were correct in noting that a well-regulated, honest market was absolutely critical to attracting capital, we probably didn't recognize the speed at which other markets would begin to develop a meaningful regulatory system and, of course, the variety of macroeconomic things that happen to their economies and the competitive flexibility that was provided, such as Big Bang in the United Kingdom, and changes in access requirements in Europe and the rest, that allowed people to compete more and started to move Europe and Hong Kong and to some degree the Tokyo Stock Exchange into positions to really truly compete. In ways that hadn't existed before. So now, Commission was very focused on it, as I think they have been every step of the way. The challenge is, where are you willing to take risk that may harm investors versus the balance of trying to ensure you have an environment that is competitively attractive so those very same investors have access to product.
Right.
And that's always been the balance the commission has wrestled with. Sometimes we got it right, sometimes we got it wrong. But it certainly wasn't, and I don't think the history speaks at all from the early 80s on, that it wasn't very focused on, and the commission didn't make conscious efforts to gradually expand and make the U.S. markets more accessible.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't done quickly enough,
right.
and maybe that's sort of the lesson of history in the last 20 years, but it certainly was a big focus.
Well, the SEC is going to, institutionally, it wants to err on the side of protecting American stockholders. Right?
The SEC is fundamentally an investor protection agency.
Yeah.
And that has been to the great benefit of, I think, both investors and the U.S. markets from a confidence standpoint. And all of that's to the good, but sometimes it makes the SEC a little slow in recognizing
right.
a change in competitive realities. That's the other piece of ensuring you have great markets. That's perhaps the lesson of the last 20 years, though there's always been the effort to continually open it up.
Something else going on here. Congress actually mandated the 1980 study of the international security,
right.
1987 study of the international securities market.
Right.
Now, were you involved in that from a market reg standpoint?
Yes. Yeah. We were. I got to say, I don't have huge individualized, really, a lot of the thinking from the standpoint of how to both make the markets more attractive from a registration standpoint with respect to issuer registration to many of the MOU things and the rest came out of that study and review. I don't have more specific recollections of it, though.
Okay.
A lot of it was on the corporate finance side,
right.
a little bit on the investment management and 40 Act side where there were very clear restrictions on access issues and the rest, and so we were a smaller part.
Okay.
But all of that sort of spun out, and that helped the effort with respect to Rule 15a6, et cetera.
Great. Getting toward 1987, right. And I want to touch on computerized trading some more.
Sure.
I mean, we talked about some of the early electronic trading systems just very briefly. I wonder if we can get into you're becoming aware of these mini crashes and market drops.
Sure.
and I know that a lot of this is driven by the rise of the options.
Sure.
Market.
I mean, as you moved in a bull market and you got into an environment where there was far greater use of index derivative index products and there it became apparent that the impact of all that and the speed, again, not being pejorative at all, but the speed at which you could shift positions and trade positions on the future side and a lesser degree on the options, index options side, had changed markets a lot. The time, markets, short-term volatility, intraday volatility, became far more pronounced in the markets as you moved into 1986 and the beginning of 1987. You started, the term market break began to be used. There became more concern with respect to Congress. A lot of the concern was focused on trading strategies that were basically reacting to the fact that the futures market can move more quickly and price more quickly than the stock market.
And that's the PT boat.
That's the PT boat. We're back to the PT boat.
Okay.
And the aircraft carrier. What that means from a pricing standpoint is that if major players in the market think that the market should be going up, the futures will rise quicker than the stock market. So the futures price will be relatively higher than its fair value versus the bundle of stocks that compose the indexes. That provides an opportunity for something called index arbitrage, which is pretty simple. If you have equivalent products, a basket of stocks on one side and a stock index future on the other side, and the stock index future is, relatively speaking, priced higher than the basket of stocks, if you can sell the stock index future and buy the basket of stocks, over time, once you move past this price movement, those prices will converge. And so you will have bought the basket of stocks cheap, and you will have sold the future dear, and you will have made money. And particularly as the strategy was initially really focused on, those spreads and the time to take to close that up were pronounced, and they made a lot of money. So it became something done a lot and a lot. And
you mean there was plenty of time to make those moves?
Relatively speaking, time meant minutes, but today it would mean a couple seconds. And the breadth of the difference, the breadth of the spread was more, because the stock markets, I won't go into detail on that. You can sort of go back to a useful supplement to this is the panel on the 1987 crash last year. It's sometimes hard to imagine this at this point, that the New York Stock Exchange in 1986 and 1987, while it did allow for electronic transmission of orders down to the post where the specialist was, most of the trading was still done face-to-face by floor brokers. And the electronic transmission of orders printed out in a manual printer. Not on a computer screen, in a manual printer. A clerk tore them off, and when the specialist got around to it, it got executed. This was a substantial increase in speed in what had ever occurred before. I'm not trying to make fun of it. This was an incremental step to much more efficient markets, but it obviously could get overloaded, and it was still slow. So, there was sand in the gears, and prices diverged, and index arbitrage became very significant. So people focused a lot on index arbitrage, which was really fundamentally the messenger, nothing more, to the fact that the futures markets could rise more quickly and the index options than the stock market, because it took time to execute all those stocks on the stock market side to sort of catch up with the market sentiment.
So is this where you're getting these tiny little market breaks?
Well, you're seeing the tiny market breaks. You're also seeing it because just as each time you get something that provides greater liquidity, people tend to overdo it. And futures and options offer two things to people that they had not had before. The ability to buy and sell a lot of stock equivalents very quickly at relatively low cost, and the ability to have higher leverage because margins on the future side were designed very differently than margins on the stock side, still dealing with depression concerns and the like. And so the leverage was much greater. All that might be good, might be bad, but what it does do is in that type of environment, suddenly price movements that would occur in a long time period now started to be condensed into a much shorter time period. And the other thing is, until people develop controls, this increase in leverage and increase in speed start to create what was referred to, if you look at the Brady report and the market regulation report on the crash, as illusions of liquidity. Probably the best example of illusions of liquidity, something which we've been fated to repeat again and again in the last 20 years, was in more sophisticated fashions. It was what happened to long-term capital management, but was something called portfolio insurance. Portfolio insurance was a basically logical theory that said, hey, you know, if I have to buy puts to hedge a stock position or to become or buy calls to become bullish or bearish in the market quickly and efficiently, that's nice, but that costs a lot of money because I have to pay a premium for a put. I have to pay a premium for a call. But I can do something called portfolio insurance, and instead I will program through baskets of securities to sell enough futures and enough stocks as the market goes down or as the market goes up to simulate as if I had bought a put or if I bought a call, but do it at much less transaction cost than if I paid the premiums for all those puts and calls.
And this is in program trading.
This is part of program trading. Portfolio, you would do it through programs.
Yeah.
Now, there was only one problem with that theory, something that, as I say, an error that we've done again and again, we the financial industry, for 20 years. That's all nice until the market suddenly becomes volatile and people get scared. But a basic rule of markets is that when liquidity disappears, it disappears completely. Mm. And suddenly the theory that you can sell a certain amount of stock at each price level as the market goes down, when the market goes down really fast, as it did a little bit in the signs coming up to 87, some of the volatility, but as it did dramatically on those days on Friday and Monday and October 16th and 19th, 1987, the liquidity disappears. And suddenly you have people on a rote basis selling large amounts of stock into the market and that continue to cause a snowballing effect of the market going down and down and down. Yeah. Not by any means the sole cause of 1987, but an evidence of what happens, particularly early on when you bring in a new innovation like stock index futures with new capabilities. But then people make the error of assuming that they have an unlimited amount of liquidity.
Now, you knew what was going on with the index futures and in the market, and you'd seen these. There were the little breaks in 86. Did you know about this portfolio insurance?
Yes, we were following it a great deal. We spent a good deal of time talking about it with people in the industry. There was testimony before Congress. This was just as you move into the summer of 87 is when Dave Ruder came on after John Shadd went off to be ambassador of the Netherlands. And we spent a great deal of time talking about it. Dave, I remember, made a speech about this at the Chicago Bond Club, I think it was, and the same day that the market went down over 100 points for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was very much a focus. There were you'll see from the archives, the Market Reg was doing studies with regard to the impact of futures in these kind of mini market breaks for the time going up to the crash.
Well, take me to the market crash. What were you doing on the, I guess it was October 16th?
What was I doing on October 16th? On October 16th, I was actually out at Denver at the SEC regional conference that occurred every year, run by then Bob Davenport, the regional administrator of Denver, and a wonderful guy who managed to pull us all out there. We could never quite figure out why, because we love them. I then went home, spent much of the weekend talking with my staff and some people in the industry. I was in New York on Monday morning, where I was supposed to be participating in a conference talking about one of the other little disasters of the 1980s, which was some of the failures in the government securities repo market that led to the Government Securities Act, and with that, the initial regulation of government securities dealers for the first time. The conference started at 8:30. I was moderator. I gave an initial introduction, excused myself, and called Mark Fitterman and Brandon Becker, who were two of my senior people, and Brandon obviously later on became director of market regulation. They told me that they'd been canvassing the industry, the indications from both the exchange with respect to orders and everything suggested it was going to be worse than our worst fears had been. Obviously, the weekend had been a series of incredibly negative articles in the press with respect to how leveraged the market was, et cetera. So they said it was going to clearly be way down at the opening. So I bid adieu to my panel on government securities regulation. I went down to the floor of the exchange, where I met with Bob Birnbaum, who was then president of the New York Stock Exchange under John Phelan. Phelan was overseas that day. You know, from the histories, he came back that night, I think. Mm-hmm. Bob took me down to the floor where I stood with Don Stone. Way back from the National Market Advisory Board, Don was still the chair of his specialist firm, and I can remember what Don said as we were watching. And this was now, markets had opened, markets were just falling dramatically, and then they were hitting a pause sometime in the period around 10:15, 10:30, where you'd hope that they were going to rebound up. And I can remember what Don said to me. Which is, my guys were heroes on Friday. They took huge positions. We don't have this kind of capital. we can't stand in front of this train. Mm-hmm. And I had those words ringing in my ear. I went back upstairs with Birnbaum. It was the market started precipitously falling again. I talked to Dave Reuter, who had been doing a speech that morning, which is somewhat famous within the context of this for one thing Dave said. And talked to Dave, talked to my staff again, and thought, I'm in the wrong city. And so I headed to the airport because it was clear to me this is just going to keep going. I headed to the airport to get back to Washington, where I got back and stood with my staff. And again, a picture of the SEC at the time. The SEC, the chairman's office, had literally no market terminal. Absolutely none. So Market Reg, as primitive as our setups were with respect to our couple of Reuters terminals, et cetera, was the focal point. I had Dave Reuter came down, Ed Fleischman, Joe Grunfest, three of the commissioners at the time, sort of gathered around us, and I remember the spooky feeling between 3 and 4 where in silence you watched the market just go down. In today's terms, there was never any green ink on the screen. It was always red. Every trade appeared to be down from the trade before. And you just basically sunk in a free fall to an unheard percentage loss on a single day. And it was terrifying. That night, we spent our time talking with trying to identify where the risks were, sweeping to understand what the firm's losses had been, what their biggest exposures from customers were, working with the CFTC to understand the exposures then, working with the Options Clearing Corporation, which had some significant risk issues, particularly with a firm called First Options, which was then owned by Continental Bank. The Chicago Merc had some questions with respect to whether and confusion with respect where for a period of time it was unable to deliver with respect to its marks. And our really effort was to try to pull together information and understand exactly where and what the risk was. And the other piece was we put out that next morning after talking to the firms and what it needed, an interpretive position that with respect to what was then Rule 13E2, which is the safe harbor with regard to issuer repurchases. And if there was any natural buyer left in America, it was the corporate issuers who now may have felt that their stocks had been trampled upon and were dramatically underpriced from what they viewed as value. Yet you had the safe harbor that didn't let people purchase purchase in the last 20 minutes, maybe even 30 minutes at that point, of the day, and couldn't purchase on an uptick, very, very restrictive. It was only a safe harbor, and so we put our interpretation to emphasize that there were a lot of very good non-manipulative reasons to issuers to be in the market, and a safe harbor was what it meant, and that there would be no negative presumption taken with respect to issuer purchases. And in fact, issuer purchases on Tuesday were a significant part of the support that came through. Tuesday, of course, was to me the most terrifying day of the crash. You started partially because of the issue repurchases. The market jabbed up 100 or more points instantaneously off of the opening, and then started to sink. And by noontime, it had lost all the points that we gained, and you really weren't a point. I mean, about the only thing you could say about this time was, literally every preconception you had about how markets operated, what were floors, how far the market would fall, had disappeared. If you want to think analogously with respect to the fear that has taken control in frozen credit markets in existing today, suddenly you had a lack of understanding of where the bottom was, where value truly was. And you watched it go like that. It was at that time that John Phelan called up Dave Reuter, and again, some of the controversies over the time, and said that the exchange was effectively closed because there were no buyers. And that he was going to do everything he could to keep the market open, but there might come a point where that couldn't occur. He also talked to the White House. There was an exchange, whatever that exchange was. interesting commentary on that with respect to Charles Cox at the round table on the crash. It was quite an interesting piece that I don't think had been part of history before. And then, for whatever reasons, issuer repurchases coming in, God is good, who knows, the market bounced and went back up. And while you then went through numerous days of afterquakes and of volatility, things stabilized.
Well, so you knew about an awful lot of, obviously you knew a lot of what was precipitating all of this. You didn't know what it would feel like when the market behaved the way you never imagined it would. When you went into and did your market reg study in the aftermath, what did you find out that you didn't know?
Well, we found out there was quite a significant focus of selling to a reasonable number of individuals, some of that portfolio insurance. We found that that there had been a variety of areas where the markets had not performed as well as they could. In the NASDAQ market, whether for technology or fear, there was a large incidence of market makers not answering their phones, and their basic nascent electronic execution system called SOES, famous for other reasons later on, basically stopped working because at that point it was a voluntary system and all market makers pulled their quotes from it. On the New York Stock Exchange, the environment I described, dependent on printers, became completely overwhelmed. And so there were large delays in executing orders. And with that, the fear of not understanding really what happened to your order, which, and any time you have lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, and fear, it results in more selling because markets hate uncertainty. So the exchange wasn't able to handle the explosion of volume. Many good things from the fact that the exchanges and people kept buying, market makers kept, with exceptions, basically filled their role from the standpoint of buying securities on all of this and the like. The other thing you found out, which we knew close to the time, was specialists were profoundly undercapitalized, not part of large holding companies as they are today. And there were many specialists at the end of Monday and Tuesday morning who were on the edge of bankruptcy, or on the edge certainly of being out of net capital. That led to Merrill Lynch, the first large firm ever being part of the New York Stock Exchange floor through purchasing a specialist, a new regulatory environment that allowed, with severe restrictions, holding companies to own specialists, which has been an important piece. And then, you know, a large part of the analysis was, again, does it make sense to have two different regulators and two different margin structures and the rest operating when, certainly if nothing else was proven and clear, and we knew this already, but the markets were fundamentally linked. And then the last piece that focused was, both because of technology problems, mostly because of technology problems, arbitrage basically stopped during the day, and the futures price diverged farther and farther from the stock price and went down farther and farther. Does that mean that the futures caused a crash? No, but it did underline what happened when the markets became unlinked. And that led to the decision made by the President's Working Group that was set up as a result of the crash, which is the beginning of the President's Working Group, and recommendation by the Brady Commission that circuit breakers be put in place for these cataclysmic days in which there was so much uncertainty and lack of knowledge that there were no buyers, but that those circuit breakers always be on a system-wide basis. So the focus was in taking steps to make our clearance systems more resilient, in taking steps to ensure that the exchanges and NASDAQ dramatically upgrade their capacity and technology capabilities so that the type of technology problems that occurred never occurred again, and then system-wide circuit breakers, sort of some of the things that came out of it.
You'd been talking a little bit about circuit breakers in advance, I guess maybe a different term.
But. Yeah, you did do research. I'm afraid. Yeah, I'd given a speech before the crash at the Futures Industry Association, in which I raised the possibility that, system-wide circuit breakers might be one way to deal with extraordinary circumstances.
So you got your circuit breakers.
We got our circuit breakers. For better or worse, we got our circuit breakers. I'm glad they haven't been used very much.
Real quick, are you about out of time? Or
I'm going to run out fairly soon. I'd love to be glad to.
Let's get to the end of the SEC.
Sure.
I want to real quick touch on one more thing that came out of all the upheavals in the early 80s and the M&As and all that is the one share, one vote,
right,
which I know you were involved with.
Yeah, I cared a lot about that. That was again, sort of the moments I felt strongly about in my career, albeit we didn't win the lawsuit. You were in an environment in what, obviously, as you moved through the 80s, of the real expansion of hostile takeovers. And for better or worse, perhaps responding to a lack of effective corporate governance or whatever else. And the U.S., again, had a relatively flexible system at the moment for allowing such things. The result of that was a variety of steps taken by companies, most of which have been dealt with by Delaware corporate law, things like poison pills and the rest that raised a variety of controversies. But one of the issues was efforts by companies to build on what before had really been a phenomenon of sort of only family-owned companies, where the family didn't want to lose control as they went public, of multiple classes of stock to cement management control while still raising capital. The New York Stock Exchange had always had a requirement, consistently employed except for Ford, but it's just called too big to say no, I guess. Of a one share, one vote. None of the other exchanges had. Neither the NASDAQ or the Amex, as the other two listing exchanges, had. The Amex had some restrictions, but nothing like one share, one vote, and the rest. Suddenly, none of that had mattered a great deal, but suddenly it began to matter more. The exchange began to feel very pressured to permit multiple classes of securities because of the competition, particularly from NASDAQ. More and more companies were trying to create these multiple classes of stock. And the exchange, as I recall, filed something like a moratorium with respect to its one share, one vote requirement, saying that it had to do it from a competitive standpoint. That led us to propose Rule 19c4, which was an effort to try to draw a line that eventually was more or less implemented in the Arthur Levitt days with a voluntary effort across all listing exchanges. This was an actual commission rule that would have not said there could only be one share, one vote. It would have grandfathered companies that had multiple classes of stock before they went public, but said that you could not, through issuing stock, take any action that would disparately impact in a significant way one class of shareholders versus another class of shareholders. Would have effectively tried to deal with the various defensive things companies were trying to do with two classes of stock. And that was, we did a hearing. It was an exceptionally controversial rule with strong feelings with respect to both sides. Really one of the first corporate governance events with respect to a strong focus on that stuff.
Did you help prep for the hearings on Capitol Hill?
Absolutely. Yeah, all of that was prepped during my time. Market Reg basically did it with support from John Huber and Corp Fin, but because we were essentially amending exchange rules, this was our rule proposal. And the impressive thing was what was the willingness with a great deal of negotiation to find a point in which Ed Fleischman and Joe Grunfest, who were both quite concerned about burdens on competition and generally deregulatory in philosophy, were willing to join on with regard to the proposal. And we reached that point with the final design, and I think it was quite a good rule. Sadly, The D.C. Circuit reached a conclusion that it wasn't consistent with the Act and went beyond our authority to basically impact exchanges rules that didn't run to regulating members but ran to restricting issuers. So the rule was abrogated by the D.C. Circuit, and that then led, on the other side of my tenure, shortly after my tenure, to Arthur Levitt's initiative to basically solve that commission jurisdiction issue by encouraging strongly all the listing exchanges to adopt the common rule. And Arthur deserves tremendous credit for having shepherded it through. An interesting irony, because the Amex was the primary protagonist in being unwilling to move to a system of one share, one vote during the efforts, or our system of 19C4 during the efforts, and a significant change in Arthur's views as he became chairman of the SEC. But really a great effort on his part to get something accomplished.
Well, one more big sort of landmark here is the Market Reform Act is coming in at this point, around 1990 or so. And again, were you involved with framing, with helping to you know, provide the input for this legislation? What was driving
it? Remind me, what was the Market Reform Act?
I think essentially what you're doing, what was happening, was institutionalizing a lot of the things that you were doing.
Do you remember the pieces of it?
I do not. No, I don't have that with me.
Yeah, we probably should have a phone call. I'd have to refresh my recollection on exactly what it did.
Great.
I mean, the other piece of legislation that I felt quite good about that sort of came out of the crash and out of the failure of Drexel, not something we've talked about here, was a piece of legislation that would, for the first time, gave the commission some minimal authority with respect to holding companies of broker dealers. And I think that may have been part of the market.
You know what?
Reform.
I think that was
part of it, as I recall. Yeah. I just can't remember the name. I'm pretty sure that's it. And that, as I say, that was another rollout from the standpoint of the crash, from the standpoint of the failure of Drexel Burnham. You know, really, until Bear Stearns, the largest failure of a major firm in U.S. securities history, or certainly since sort of the days of the paperwork crisis and the rest. And that was, that, as I say, the key part of the market, if that was a reform, was the creation, the beginning of holding company regulation that now has evolved to the commission's position as a consolidated regulator for major firms that are not banks.
And the SEC could go in and sort of assess the health of a company.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Could assess the health of the minimal reporting requirements and the ability to assess the health of the holding company, because much of the learning with respect to Drexel Burnham, which obviously exploded in importance as firms became more global and as they pressed into more unregulated products like over-the-counter derivatives and swaps, was that much of the contagion when a firm started getting in trouble was really occurring outside of the regulated broker-dealer. And if you didn't have the full picture of the holding company, you didn't know what was going on. And that was, you know, you did a great job of research, because if I were to hit yet another sort of the fence posts, the mileposts that were done in the 80s that remained important and sort of led the way to where the commission's gone in the last 17 years, that would be the last one, is the beginning of our holding company regulation. Again, something's just going. Hi. Yeah, just one more minute, Sylvia. I know.
All right.
So, I think you hit it. I think you nailed it. You got
perfect
it.
Perfect place to stop.
Perfect place
Thank
to stop.
Thank you so much.